This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
Lois Price.
Thank you.
Welcome. Welcome, everybody. Welcome, Lois.
Thank you.
I'm delighted to welcome this woman onto the stage because she's got some wonderful traveller's tales from a part of the world that I think very few of us have had the opportunity to visit, and that, of course, is Iran. It's a country of contradictions, it's a country of delights, and it's brought Lois unexpected wonders, I think, as well as moments of danger and fear and plenty of laughter along the way. So please welcome Lois, who is the author of Revolutionary Ride, On the Road in Search of the Real Iran. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Thanks for coming, everybody.
I want to start off away from Iran, just to give people an idea of you. Mm-hmm. Tell us what you added in to your wedding vows.
I'm lucky enough to be married to a very adventurous man who is one of the only two people that thought that going to Iran on a motorcycle on my own was a good idea. And I guess he had to go along with it, because when we got married 12 years ago, we did the usual wedding vows, and then we also had a very serious vow which we repeated to each other in front of everyone, where we promised to support each other in any harebrained schemes, crackpot plans, and ill-thought-through adventures. And this is recited very formally in the wedding, and we've been doing that pretty much ever since.
And probably this trip comes under the definition of
all three of them.
So tell us where the idea came from, where it started.
Well, I should go back probably to 2003 when I did my first long-distance motorcycle adventure, which was from Alaska to the bottom of Argentina, so all of the Americas, and that resulted in my first book. I came back from that trip, all my friends and family like, oh, well, you've got that out of your system now, you know, and your bum must be killing me, and you never want to sit on a bike again. And I was like, actually, it's quite the opposite. And then, of course, as I'm sure all you people will know, you get the map out on the floor and you start planning adventure number two. So that was from London to Cape Town, so the length of Africa. And then I was sort of always, you know, you're always thinking about what to do next. And I happened to be near the Iranian embassy on my bike one day in 2011. And it was just after there'd been a big diplomatic kind of kickoff between Iran and Britain. And they'd set fire to our embassy in Tehran, and we'd thrown them out and they'd thrown us out. And there was this real low point in Anglo-Iranian relations, which have been pretty fiery for hundreds of years, really. But this was an all-time low. And I parked my bike near the Iranian embassy, just went for a meeting, came back, and I found this little note on my bike, which is not an unusual thing because, you know, travel bikes, we kind of all know each other in that world, and someone might recognise my bike and would have said, you know, hello, Lois, nice bike or something. But it wasn't that. It was from a mysterious man by the name of Habib, who said, you know, I like your bike. Have you ever been to Iran on it? You should not believe what you read in the news, because obviously the news was full of stories about terrorism and nuclear scientists and all sorts, you know. So it's all very, very bad anti-Iran news. And then this random guy took it upon himself to write this little note sort of saying, we're not terrorists, come and see for yourself. Because he could tell my bike was a travelling bike. And I thought, what a funny thing to do. But quite sweet. And I didn't really think anything more about it. But that's what fired my interest in Iran, and I started following the news stories and became more and more interested, in particular with the British relationship with Iran and how fiery that's been. And it wasn't really till I got to Iran 2 years later that it made perfect sense to me, that note, that actually is emblematic of the Iranian nature and hospitality, the need to connect with the world and the need to show the world that they are not this sort of evil nation that we often hear about.
And that note was talking to you specifically, sort of inviting you to Shiraz, which is down in the south of the country. But you started, your route began in the northwest, didn't it?
Exactly.
With a visa for yourself, but no visa for the bike.
Yeah, it was pretty sketchy from the start. So obviously applying to go to Iran, as a woman, a British woman on a motorcycle is tricky, especially at that time. And I should say that Iranian women are forbidden from riding motorcycles, along with a million other things they're forbidden from doing. Riding motorcycles is one of them. Foreign women are allowed to for some reason, but Iranian women aren't. So I applied for the visa, and they said, yes, you can come, eventually, after lots of interrogations of weird questions, like, what does your dad do for a living and stuff like that. So they said, OK, you can come, but you can't come on a motorcycle. You can't come on your own transport. You have to use public transport. Now, there's a lot of sort of monitoring of activity and movement in Iran, so I guessed it was to do with that. It could have been as part of the Islamic law about women riding bikes. I just didn't know, and they don't give an explanation. So I was like, oh, no, you know, this is what I do. This is how I get around. I have to ride my bike. I'm not getting on the bus, you know. So I was a bit gutted about that. And I said to the lady that organised my visa, you know, this is a terrible blow to me because that's how
that's
I like
who
to
you start. Are.
Yeah, this is yeah. This is how I get around, you know. So, and she said, oh, she was a very gung-ho lady. She said, oh, don't worry about it. They won't know. Just turn up, you'll be fine. And I was like, really? And I was quite scared of the idea of sort of taking on the border guards or the, you know, the Ministry of Tourism, whatever it is, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in the Islamic Republic of Iran. It sounded quite intimidating. And she said, I bet you turn up at the border, they won't know. And she said, or you could just put the bike on the train, sneak it into the country from Turkey, and then just ride off. So that's actually what I ended up doing. And it was brilliant. It was no problem at all. So so it's always worth you know, taking these rules and regulations with a certain element of
pinch of salt.
Yeah, pinch of salt, a bit of flexibility, yeah.
So there you are, you've got your bike, you've got your helmet. Tell us about the practicalities, given that, you know, in Iran, women are generally asked to cover up.
Absolutely. So by law, women, visitors and Iranian women, have to cover their hair, so wear a headscarf. And they also have to wear something called a manto, like the French word for coat. So it's a sort of thigh-length sort of shirt dress thing to hide the supposedly irresistible curves of your bum. so I would wear this kind of... I was kind of combining Islamic clothing with my motorcycle clothing, which is quite a peculiar look. So I'd have my helmet on and all my hair tucked up because I didn't want the hair coming out the back, you know, from flowing out, you know, Penelope Pitstop style, because obviously that would be against the rules, you know. So every time I stopped, I'd have to whip my helmet off and then I'd have this headscarf in my pocket, which I'd quickly cover up my hair. And then I wore my motorcycle jacket sort of over this dress, over my jeans with my boots, you know, so I looked quite odd. and there's a lot of subtleties, and you realise when you're in Iran that clothing becomes a signifier of who are the people like you, who can you trust, and that's how Iranians operate. So the more sort of liberal, urbanite people, the women will wear their headscarves literally hanging off the back of their head, lots of makeup, sort of skinny jeans, trainers, that kind of thing, over this coat dress thing. The more traditional women will wear a headscarf tied under their chin, and then the really religious traditional women will wear the big black cloak, the chador. So it's and you realise that you sort of use this to sort of suss out what you can say and who you can talk to and who will think what, and it becomes really like a code.
Yeah, lots of different signals.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So you've got your freedom because of the bike,
yes.
But I guess that also brings a certain amount of vulnerability with it as well, because it's you and a bike. It's not like you can close the doors of a car even.
Well, to me, this is the actual appeal of motorcycle travel. I mean, in a way, you could see it as a downside, but it means you are truly in the moment all the time. So whatever the weather is, whatever if it's boiling hot or there's a sandstorm or it's raining or it's snowing or there's a crowd of people and you're amongst it, you can't ever escape. But that is the joy of it, and it really it gets you out there. Well, as if you were driving a car or something, you know, you'd just be able to wind up the window and drive off, you know. But you can't, and that makes you engage with the place that you're in environmentally, with the people, in everything. But of course, you know, it means it's quite an intense experience, but that's what you go for, you know.
So how different is your bike from the sort of motorbike we might see parked up outside? Obviously fairly different, because otherwise the note wouldn't have been there in the first place.
I think if you sort of know about bikes, I mean, I'm not really a biker as such, and I'm not sort of into the bikes themselves. It's more what you can do with them, really, so that I'm interested in. But you can sort of tell a travelling bike in that it will have a big petrol tank, because you need to be able to go long distances, especially if you're crossing deserts. So it'll often have luggage, like old panniers and bags on it. And a telltale sign is often a sheepskin on the seat, because you're sitting there for a long time and it gets a bit painful.
And how good are you at motorcycle maintenance?
I'm not bad. I mean, because I've done all these trips and I've had to fix things along the way. Before my first trip, 2003, I did a motorcycle maintenance course just to learn the basics of repair. I wouldn't take an engine apart, but I can certainly keep a bike going and replace things that have worn out. And I know what to do to maintain a bike and keep it running and sort of listen out for faults and that kind of thing. So I can get by. I'm not a mechanic, you know, I'm not an engineer or anything, but it's pretty simple. The stuff you need to know to keep a bike going on the road is quite straightforward.
The other huge advantage that it gives you is that you can go off down tracks exactly. and up over mountains. Tell us about going up into the snowy mountains.
Yeah, I think that is really the sheer joy of motorcycling. It comes from motorcycle travel or using a bike to travel comes from that autonomy that you talk about, in that you could be going along a perfectly normal road and then you see an enticing track going up a mountain or going down to the beach and you just think, oh, I wonder what's down there, you know, and you can go and explore. Well, of course, if you're on a bus or flying around the place, you haven't got that flexibility. So I really tried to make the most of that. And in the northern part of Iran, there's the Alborz Mountains, which run along the coast of the Caspian Sea. They're absolutely most beautiful mountains, and so I spent a lot of time exploring them, but unfortunately I got caught out in a huge snowstorm and I actually got forced back because the snow was so deep I literally couldn't ride through it. But again, that was an example of, you know, there's nothing but eagles flying in the sky, and you think you could only have got here really on a dirt bike, you know, so it's a great example of that.
And you look back at that fondly as an adventure and you got through it. But what was going through your mind at the time?
I was so cold, and how the hell am I ever going to get out of here?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's always balancing that, being so trying to relish the moment and not worry about what's happening. But and that's more difficult than it sounds, because you can get caught up in the fears of, oh, I'm lost, or I'm going to break down, or what would happen if I got stuck here or something like that. So there's... That's sort of really the essence of a motorcycle journey, is sort of trying to balance that sort of excitement and then the sort of, you know, worries of what could go wrong, especially if you're on your own, of course. Yeah.
And there was also some, well, apparent human menace when you were followed by a couple of cars. tell us what happened.
So in those mountains, there's very lonely roads, and I was very aware of in Iran of being looked at a lot, because obviously I was a novelty on a foreign registered bike with a British plate, really stood out. And obviously once people realised I was a woman, they couldn't understand what the hell I was doing there, you know. So I would be stared at all the time, always friendly curiosity, but I was aware of it sort of being this travelling circus, really. And one time I was on these dark, lonely roads, mountain roads, and I was trying to find somewhere to stay, and I realised I was being followed by two cars. And of course, there is a culture of a secret police in Iran. There's a culture of tourists being arrested for spying and locked up and, you know, never being heard of again and all this. And there was no British diplomatic representation at the time. So, you know, that was it. There was going to be no ambassador with a nice cup of tea. Oh, don't worry, I'll get you out of there. You know, I was very aware of that. And so when I realised that these cars were following me, because every time I stopped, they stopped. Every time I carried on, they carried on. And they stayed slowly behind me. I was really scared, and it was getting darker and darker. I was in complete wilderness mountains, and I was thinking, I don't know where I'm going to stay, what's going to happen, you know. And I was planning, you know, your mind goes wild and you're planning your escape route and like writing it notes in indelible ink or something, you know. It's like and in the end, this lonely little hotel appeared in the middle of nowhere, and I sort of pulled in there, and the cars pulled in and followed me. And all these people jumped out and like ran after me. And I saw this guy holding this glinting piece of metal in his hand. And I was, you know, thinking the worst. And it was a cafetiere. And he said, do you want some coffee? And it was just a group of youngsters from Tehran. They were all kind of, I suppose you'd call them Iranian hipsters, really, kind of artists and musicians and people that work in the theatres, which is all kind of underground in Iran, because it's not allowed formally. Mm. And they'd gone away for the weekend to escape the presence of the police. And they go to the mountains and, you know, they take illegal alcohol and some weed and some tea and some shisha, and they had a party, and I was invited. So it was a great lesson for me in controlling the imagination, you know, and realising that actually most bad situations aren't bad situations at all.
Yeah. So, I mean, that comes to the point about contradictions, doesn't
yes.
it? That what it appears on the surface
oh,
to
absolutely.
Be is nothing. And that's something that you found right throughout the country, I think.
Yeah, I mean, Iranians live in a sort of two lives, really, a public life and a private life. Because they're banned from, obviously, from drinking, but from having parties, dancing, music. You can't just join a band and put on a gig, you know, or run a club like we couldn't in the West. So, but that stuff still happens because you can't keep it down. You know, it's a human need to mix with people, to make music, to make films, to make art, and all of that happens, but all secretly, all behind closed doors. And people make films and they pass them to each other on USB sticks and stuff like, you know. So there's this whole sort of secret life, and the same with the clothing, women. You know, in the shops, you can buy all this sort of saucy clothes, like mini skirts and lacy tops and all this. But no one wears them out, of course, because it's forbidden. So they wear them at home. So it's only until you enter the Iranian home that you see this whole world. And they've got, you know, a secret stash of whiskey behind the Quran or whatever. So, and there's this whole sort of secret life going on, which is absolutely fascinating. And the Iranian people are very, very happy to invite you in and to share their lives and their stories with you, which is just wonderful.
So supposedly secret, but the authorities presumably know and accept a certain amount of this going on.
Yes, they certainly do. And really, I mean, everyone will tell you that it's the authorities that are running the smuggling of the alcohol and the illegal satellite television services and everything. You know, so that's the Revolutionary Guards, who are the kind of militia, essentially, of the Ayatollah. They're incredibly powerful, more powerful than the police, and they, you know, have a hand in all of this sort of subversive stuff. But when it suits them, they'll crack down on it as well. So it's not unheard of parties to have a crackdown raid, and for the, you know, or for satellite dishes to be sort of pulled out of people's roofs and that kind of thing. So what I'm really impressed with me about the Iranians, with this incredible subversiveness, and they're slightly sort of cheeky and naughty. They almost sort of enjoy getting away with stuff, and so I found that very, very appealing. And that's just how they live, sort of always pushing it all the time, you know. But it just goes to show that those human desires can't be. They just can't be repressed.
Yeah. And it shows a similarity between cultures.
Oh, absolutely.
Because we all like to push it every now and
yeah,
then,
it's
don't
nice
we?
To There's get away with something,
scanning.
Isn't it? Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
One of the other similarities that it struck me in your book was this huge politeness.
Yeah.
There's a similarity with the British.
Very
and
much so.
Tell us about the concept of, is it Taruf?
Tarof.
Tarof.
Yeah, so they have a tradition called Tarof, which is it's formalised politeness, so, and it is similar to us Brits as well, along with all the tea drinking. You know, I felt quite at home actually. And so, they, in the way that we would open a door and they say, "You go first," and then they know you, and you can stand there for, you know, or we'll insist on paying for a meal, and then your friend says, "No, I'll pay." It's that, but it's actually it's sort of understood and has a name and is a formal thing, and it happens in business and. Amongst friends, and as a foreigner, you'll be told, "Oh no, you mustn't pay for a taxi ride or buy something in a shop." But you have to sort of understand that you're meant to go back and forth three times, and then you do have to pay. But you still have to go through this kind of crazy rigmarole. But it's something quite charming about it, really.
Yeah, and did it take you a while to cotton on, or was that something that you...
Yeah, no, it did, and I got it explained to me quite early on, luckily. Some people go to Iran, they don't work it out until they've got home and realise that they didn't pay any of the taxi drivers, you know. But luckily I met some people quite early on who explained some sort of important points about Iranians and Persians and the language and the culture, so that was very helpful.
So tell us about you went to Tabriz, you went to Tehran, you went to Shiraz. Tell us about the difference between the cities.
Yeah, certainly. Tehran, obviously, is the capital, and it's a capital that's really split between the north, which is very high-end and quite westernised, and there's a lot of money and sort of luxury cars and incredible villas and all this kind of thing. The south of Tehran is very, very poor and run down. But as a city, it's probably the most relaxed like that. I walked around in Tehran with open-toed shoes. Now, that doesn't sound like a big thing, but in Esfahan, which is a more traditional religious city, I was wearing open-toed shoes, and I've noticed people looking at me. Older men were like, you know, hadn't seen a pair of toes for a while in public. And as a foreigner, you are given a little bit more leeway, but it made me realise, oh, you know, you can't do that down here. So Tehran is a crazy quite intimidating city. It's huge, 12 million people, I think. It's enormous. And you just, the driving is terrifying. So riding a motorcycle into Tehran was one of the most challenging things I've ever done.
You describe it as almost like being in a video game.
It is. It's like you're on and you're just like fighting and battling the whole time, and you cannot let up. Your concentration is at full whack. So no one pays any attention to road signs or markings or rules. There are no rules. And you have to enter that mentality. But it's the most scary riding I've ever done. And, I've ridden, obviously, through African capital cities, South American, which were pretty crazy. But nothing had prepared me for Iranian drivers. And plus, they're all hanging out of their cars, filming me on their phone, giving me the thumbs up, waving, trying to talk to me and ask me questions while someone else is, trying to kill me, and so it was quite full on. So,
while we're on that subject, you don't have a GPS, do you?
No.
You've got your map.
So I'm not really a gadgety person, and I like paper maps and keeping everything lo-fi, and I like talking to people. I like asking directions as well, because you always end up with interesting situations and conversations. But it meant I was getting lost quite a lot. The maps are really old-fashioned. Some of them date back to before the revolution, so even the street names are all wrong. So I'd sort of end up in quite a pickle. But it always works out, because something always interesting happens.
Sorry, I interrupted you. So you're going to tell us about Shiraz.
So further south into the desert, the Esfahan, as I was saying, is a bit more conservative, traditional city. But Shiraz has this reputation amongst all Iranians as the kind of most relaxed city in Iran. I'd say it's like the San Francisco of Iran, if you can stretch it that far. It's the home of Iranian creative arts and poetry, particularly their very beloved poet Hafez is from there, plus other poets. So his tomb is there. There's a big university there, which has often been involved in sort of resistance and rebellious movements. So it has this kind of vibe, and it's known for being laid back and easygoing. Yeah. And that was a lovely place to end my journey.
So one thing that really comes through in the book is your excitement and respect for the Omidvars.
Oh, yes.
Tell us about the Omidvar brothers.
Yeah, so the Omidvar brothers were two brothers who travelled all around the world in the 1950s and 60s, Iranian brothers. They were basically the Attenborough of Iran, really. But so they were super famous explorers. They had their own TV show every week. This is all before the revolution in the 60s and 70s. They did the most incredible journeys, made these amazing films and TV shows.
They were anthropologists.
They were anthropologists, really, self-styled anthropologists, but to the extent that they really lived it. They went and lived with the tribes in the Amazon, in Eskimos, in Africa, and had incredible adventures. And they became really famous, had this show, and then when the revolution happened, their career was just ended, because they had images of, tribeswomen with no clothes or wearing gual skirts, and that was not considered Islamic, so it couldn't be shown. And so that was it, really. But one of them is still alive and lives in Iran, and he's 83 or something when I went there. I went to meet him. He's absolutely a delightful gentleman, and he's got this museum, tiny little museum, of all his incredible artifacts. And it's like shrunken heads from the Amazon and poisoned darts and elephant's feet and all of this stuff that he'd brought back from his travels. And I think it was really interesting, because we think of explorers as always a sort of Western construct. We're very familiar with Western explorers, and it tends to be European men doing it. And so the idea that these Iranians were doing the same thing and really having some amazing experiences is just not something we ever hear about here. So it was fascinating to meet him.
You talked about the big petrol tanks on your bike, but there was a situation where, and it's something that comes back to me, because whenever I get below quarter of a tank in the car, I'm thinking, right, I need to find something now. You got a little bit below quarter of a tank, didn't you?
When I ended up in that gas station in the desert. Yeah, I mean, it's funny, because Iran produces its own petrol, and it's incredibly cheap. It's like 11 pence a litre, so you're like, wow. But there's not very many petrol stations, strangely, so I ended up sort of stuck on a dark desert highway, watching the numbers ticking over on my, on my speedo, thinking, oh, my God, I'm running out. And I was down to, my last litre, I was guessing, really. And finally, a petrol station showed up just at the last minute. I mean, I was really about to run out, probably had another couple of few miles. And it it was meant to be the saving grace, but actually it turned into one of the worst incidents of the trip, because the petrol station attendant, it was completely isolated desert petrol station, just this one guy, and he was a complete nutcase. I found out later that there's a big meth problem there, and I assume that that's what he was on. Anyway, he ended up attacking me, and I ended up kicking him, and we had a sort of fight, and then I had to drive off into the desert in the darkening night, you know, with no petrol, thinking, oh my God, I've just been attacked by a complete mental, you know, drug-addled nutcase, and I'm about to run out of petrol in this really rough part of Iran, you know, and that was the low point, really, of the trip, yeah.
But you found petrol in the end.
Oh, well, I had to. Yeah, in the end, I just had to ask some guys, you know, if they could just siphon me off a bit and put it. But, you know, this is the thing that you just always make something work in the end, yeah. You know. Yeah. It always works out in the end, and that's really, I suppose, what I've learned from all of my journeys, really.
Yeah. I mean, at the other end of the spectrum, you saw some wonderful hospitality. And the people stayed within Tehran, for example, you didn't really want to leave,
I didn't want to leave. I got a bit cosy. I mean, I should say, before I left, I went completely alone, and I had one contact in Iran. Literally was a friend of a friend of a friend. That's how vague it was. But when you've got one vague contact in Iran, it means you have 100 friends, because they're on the phone to their aunt and their cousin and their friend, and you know, so they just put me in touch with a huge network of people who, for them, it was completely normal to take a stranger into their home, feed them, take them out, you know, it was absolutely part of their culture. Amazing experience. Yeah, so that was the standout experience for me. The incident in the petrol station was not at all representative, of Iranians. And that kind of thing could happen anywhere, really.
Yeah. Is there a particular moment or a particular view or image that comes back to you when you think back?
I love desert, so I'm always very happy in the desert. But I think the mountains that we mentioned before, the Alborz Mountains, were really a spectacular experience, because they're so pristine and unspoiled. And to be somewhere like that, where there's not a single... there's nothing man-made at all around you. You know, that's pretty rare, you know, when you're travelling on a motorcycle. And then later on, I went into the Zagros Mountains, which are the mountain range that run along parallel with the Iraqi border. And there you have... you still have nomads. The Bakhtiari nomads still live there. And they move up there during the summer months. And so it was incredible to see people, nomadic people, living, you know, with all their sheep and goats. That was really wonderful, and they were really friendly as well. So yeah, those two things stand out. But really, the standout attraction of Iran is the people and the chance encounters that you have, because they're so frequent and they're so warm and funny. And that's what I wasn't expecting, this sense of fun, because I've travelled in a lot of, you know, other Islamic countries where religion is a big part of the culture, and it is quite serious, and there's a lot of praying. And I was expecting that, and I didn't ever feel like that at all. But the Iranians really muck about. You know, they laugh a lot, they goon around, they climb up things and jump off and make silly faces. And so it was sort of like being at home with it, you know. And so I felt immediately at ease with their culture, really.
And obviously you were a bit of a novelty.
Yeah,
you're a woman travelling on your own in your motorcycle. But if people were thinking of going to Iran, can you imagine that they would also experience in the same way?
I mean, everyone I've ever spoken to about Iran who's been there says the same thing. Yeah. They've all experienced that immense hospitality. And also incredible conversation, really, really very poetic to talk to, and dramatic. So you end up with these incredible stories, and the lives that people lead. They're obviously living under a very repressive regime, but they're very keen to talk about the situation and politics and tell the stories. So you end up with... You know, like me, if you're a writer, you're just overwhelmed with incredible human stories told in this really poetic, dramatic way. So it's sort of a joy just to hang around them, you know. I mean, I really miss being around the Iranian people, you know, for that reason.
Are there any Iranians in the audience? She needs a friend.
Oh, really?
No. Okay. I guess, though, there's a contrast between what you're able to do in that situation and then the everyday lives of those people that you meet in terms of the freedoms.
Yes, exactly. And I met quite a few women, you know, that I'd meet women of all ages. In fact, one old lady I met when I was just entering Iran from Turkey, and she was hugging me. She was wearing the big black chador, and she was so excited I was there on my bike. She was like, hugging me and slapping me on the back and punching the air and everything. So I think that they're really pleased to see people coming to Iran. That was the overwhelming impression I got, that people were really happy that people were coming, well, I was there, or that any foreigner came to Iran, because they're so acutely aware of how their country is viewed by the rest of the world, i.e. negatively, that they really want to set that straight. And that's what made me understand the note that had left on my bike, because I can't imagine someone else doing that from another country. But once I'd been in Iran and met Iranians and realised how keen they were to connect with the outside world and how keen they were to make it known that it's an incredibly sophisticated, educated country full of, you know, open-minded people, you know, they've been really done a disservice and they want to put that straight. So, yeah.
Great. Okay, I'm sure there are some questions out there. So if you've got a question, do pop your hand up and we'll get a microphone to you. We'll come over to you first and then down here. Thank you. And maybe you've got some thoughts about practicalities, if you're thinking of travelling to that part of the world. Thank you.
Yeah.
Hiya.
Hello.
Hello. As you know, I've driven across Iran. Question for you. Problem I had was cash. When I went, you couldn't use foreign cards at all in ATMs or to pay for anything.
Yeah.
So you had to carry cash for the whole of your trip, which was something that I'd discovered when I researched it, completely forgot about when I got to the Turkish border and ended up having to borrow money off people I met on the road.
It was a problem because Iran is, because of the international sanctions, it cut off from the banking world. So you can't use a Visa card, you can't use any credit card, you cannot access any money, you can't get PayPal, nothing. So you have to go with all of your money for the trip on you. You know, I had it stuffed in my bra and, you know, down my boots and hidden on the bike, it all in dollars and euros. But you can change it anywhere. There are bureaux de change everywhere in Iran. So, but it does make, you know, it's a bit nervous having kind of that amount of cash, but there's no other way around it. Yeah, it's tricky.
You've got to do what you've got to do.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a question.
There's a chap here, yes.
Here. Yes. Just here, Roddy. Thank you.
Lois, what time of year did you go and why did you choose that time and would you choose the same time again?
That's a very good question. I went, there's a trip that I've written the book about. It was the first trip that I did that. I've actually been three times. That was in autumn, which was perfect. I got caught in some snow, but that was unusual for that time of year. I loved it so much I left my bike there over winter, went back again in spring, which again was ideal. It's a really mixed, geographically it's mixed in that it's mountainous and then very, very hot desert in the south, which is why the nomads do their moving around, because to go in the summer would be too hot in the south, really, probably for me, in the desert areas. But to go in the winter, they get really freezing temperatures as well and heavy snow. So I would say that the autumn, spring are the best for both, to cover all areas, yeah.
But I guess you can go skiing.
It is a really big skiing destination. Yeah. I mean, I'm not a skier, but that is a huge attraction here. And you see a lot of sort of swanky Tehranis with all their amazing ski gear on the slopes and everything. Yeah, yeah.
There was a question here. Yes, please.
All of your trips, they must have changed you in various ways. And I just wanted to know, please, how going to Iran had changed you differently from all your other trips.
That's an excellent
question. Yeah.
It is an interesting question, because the first trip, I think it depends on the motivation. My first trip, I was desperate to escape an office job. I'd been working since I left school, whatever. And it was all about sort of me getting out in the world and having a go and could I fix my bike and could I, you know, live on my wits and all that. Then when I went through Africa, that was a physical challenge. It was the most grueling physical thing I've ever done, going through the Congo and the Sahara and minefields and all this. So that was sort of a endurance test, really. But for going to Iran was much more of a cultural challenge, and it did have an impact on me. It made me, because I went there, part of the reason that I went was because I was aware that we have this sort of drip feed of anti-Islam, anti-Muslim you know, thought that happens, it's coming all the time around us in the news, from every news source. And even though I didn't believe in it, you know, I would think, oh, I'm a well-travelled, open-minded, you know, lefty liberal person. You can't help but be affected by it. It's all around us. And I just thought, so the idea of going to such a strict Islamic country scared me. And I thought, well, if I'm scared, fear is just a product of ignorance, so I should go out and actually find if there's something to be scared about. So that was really the thought that got me there after getting this note from Habib. And it made me realise that everything we hear is wrong, essentially. You know, that's in most simplistic terms. It was so different to what I expected, so different from what all the people told me not to go, that it would be dangerous. You know, absolutely wrong, wrong, wrong. So it made me much more tolerant. I mean, I'm always suspicious and sceptical about what I read in the newspapers, as we should all be, but it really made me just incredibly appreciative, obviously, of the culture that we live in, but also just really, really appreciative of the hospitality of the Middle East, and I feel a sort of duty to the Iranians to share the reality of Iran. So that's what the book became about, really. It wasn't about me on a bike, oh, what's it like riding around on a bike? I'd done all that. And this is much more about Iran, and I really came back really humbled by my experience there, and really, really grateful, and feeling like I needed to tell the truth about Iran.
There was a question over here. Thank you.
Hello. A question about practicalities. I've looked into going to Iran, and it seems really hard to get a visa for solo travel.
It is now.
How did you get it?
I'm afraid I was really fortunate in that I was one of the last people to get in to be able to travel independently. What happened in 2014, they changed the rules. It changed while I was there, actually, on my second trip. And they no longer allow British passport holders in unless you're on a tour. You're part of a tour group or with a government-approved guide. And this is the same for British, American and Canadians. But all of the European... If you've got a European passport, you can turn up and get a visa on arrival. See, you need to marry a Frenchman or something. Can't be a bad thing, anyway.
Any other questions? This one here, please.
Hi, Lois.
Hello.
Having met all these Iranians, do you have a sense of what the future holds for Iran?
Yeah, that's a great question, actually. What does the future hold for the Iranians? Well, as I said, the Iranians are very, very keen to talk about their situation and the political situation there. Every conversation turns around to that. It's a huge youth population in Iran, because there was a sort of official sort of revolutionary breeding programme, shall we say, in the early 80s. And now those kids have all come of age. They've all connected to the internet somehow. I mean, it's sort of forbidden, but they've managed to get around it. And they are, essentially, most of them are anti-regime. So they are desperate for change. That's the main message. But there were some protests in 2009 which didn't end well, and everyone, you know, has been locked up and shot in the street. I mean, it was terrible what happened. And it was absolutely crushed. But that movement is still sort of going on underground. But most of the people that I spoke to, all of them were desperate for change, all ages and backgrounds. But they all pretty much agreed that a revolution was not the way ahead. They wanted a gradual change. And then I happened to be there at a really significant time in Iranian history, because the nuclear deal was going through. And when I was there first, Obama and their president had spoken for... That's the first time that leaders of America and Iran had spoken for over 30 years. So people were, you know, coming up to me on the street saying, our countries are going to be friends, and really, really excited about the future. Then the nuclear deal went through, the sanctions got lifted, and there was celebrations on the streets, and the authorities turned a blind eye. You know, everyone was out partying, and, you know, just, it was an incredible scene in 2015. When I went back last year, there was a sense of sort of people feeling frustrated and let down, because the changes hadn't really come. They were hoping that there'd be a big economic boost, but actually, unfortunately, what's happened is that the hardliners in the government are showing their sort of disgust at the nuclear deal by cracking down on the Iranian people even more. So in a way, it's kind of backfired. So it's just wait and watch and see. But it's not a very happy time at the moment, unfortunately.
One last question here.
Sorry.
Oh, sorry, Roddy. Well, last question, and then other people will have to catch Lois at the stand afterwards because we're going to run out of time, but go ahead.
Thank you. If you were visiting Iran in a limited time, what would be your must-see places to visit?
Right. Where must you go?
Where must you go? I would say try to make a mixture of the cities and the countryside, because they're feels like two very different countries, so that is interesting. I would definitely take in the Alborz Mountains, and I would certainly go to Tehran. You don't need to go for a long time, but just to feel the energy and the vibe. Persepolis, which is the ancient ruins, that's obviously worth seeing. Esfahan is a beautiful, absolutely beautiful city. So I would take that in. I mean, there is a sort of standard tourist trail, I suppose, that people do, which is Esfahan and Shiraz as well, worth seeing. Persepolis is next to Shiraz, and then a couple of days into on, and then, you know, a trip into the mountains. So that you could do that in a couple of weeks. If you could extend it longer, I would say go into the Zagros Mountains and explore then. But it's about transportation and you know, need your own wheels, really, to see it. And the real joy is to get off the beaten track and to just start chatting to people. That's what you need to do most of all.
Well, in order to do that and to get an even more of a flavour than you've already given us, we've got a short film that Lois made. So let's have a look at that, and then that will give you some extra ideas.